Before we dive into today's episode, I want to tell you about a free three-act worksheet to help you structure your story. Whether you're a plotter or a pantser, a novelist or short fiction writer, this three-act worksheet will help you navigate your material and even begin each new story with a better plan. Download yours at nancypannuccio.com/act. Stop getting stuck in the middle of your draft. Go grab this free worksheet, nancypannuccio.com/act. A common misstep is feeling like you need to tell the story chronologically, everything that happened. And so the opening pages can be a tedious meandering before we get to the good stuff, and it's usually buried in a lot of extraneous details. Writer Unleashed is for you, a writer who has a story you want to bring onto the page and into the hearts and minds of readers. I'm Nancy Pannuccio, writer, editor, and writing coach. And each week, we'll explore techniques, mindsets, and inspiration for writing stories readers can't put down. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let's begin. We can all agree that your opening scenes, particularly your first scene, is your only chance to capture your reader's attention and leave them wanting more. It's what hooks them into the story. It's what draws the reader in so deeply they can't resist reading more. Your first scene and several scenes that follow are your story's setup. The setup is essential to master. You have to be concise and deliberate and selective with what you show and tell about your character. The point of the setup is not to tell us everything. There's a lot of withholding and delaying. You don't want to take numerous chapters to do this. You're not going to front load it with backstory, summary, exposition, or extraneous details. So, what constitutes your story's beginning? This is the first quarter of your book, your first scene and several scenes that follow and ultimately usher your character into Act Two, which is where the main conflict or story problem plays out. Act One is your setup. In this episode, we're going to focus on your setup, the first scene or scenes in your story. Now, often writers will start with a compelling first line or a couple of lines, and then they'll go straight into backstory, what happened hours, days, maybe even years before. So you don't want to default to dull summary or exposition. You want to resist the urge to do too much setup. A common trap writers get into with their opening is explaining too much, explaining what's happening or what happened right before, what happened in the past. You want to activate your reader's urge to know more. That's what keeps readers on the edge of their seat. So you want to give just enough for them to want to know more. You don't want to give it all away too soon. It's that urge to know more that hooks your reader into the story. Now, your setup scenes must accomplish several things simultaneously, but I'm going to boil it down to the essential four things you want to introduce. Number one, your protagonist. You want to establish the world as he or she knows it. Number two, the main story problem or goal. Number three, what's at stake for this person. And number four, the person or thing that threatens to topple the world as your character knows it. But before we get to all that, what do I mean by scene? A scene is a contained narrative unit that's a microcosm of your plot. The plot is how the events, the action, changes your main character internally over time in a meaningful way. In a scene, characters engage in meaningful action that gives readers the illusion that it's unfolding in real time. So your characters are moving through space and time. They're in a particular place, and as they move through space and time, they may interact with other characters through dialogue. They may be engaged in some situation or activity. They may observe the space around them. They may observe or interpret other characters in the scene. They may briefly dip into the past. In scene, it's happening. There's energy and momentum. So let's start with number one, introducing your protagonist. This is what you want to nail in your very first scene. A better way to think about scenes is not how they begin so much as where we meet your characters. From where in time will you let us into the room or place where your protagonist is? The best way to launch a scene is in the middle of some compelling event or activity. Here's an example from the novel The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner. And we meet Romy, who's serving two life sentences in prison for murdering her stalker. Now, she doesn't lead with this. We don't get the details of her imprisonment. We don't even learn right away that she's serving two life sentences. We don't immediately even learn about the crime. We meet her on a bus with 60 other inmates en route up the valley. We don't know why they're being transported or where, just that they're on a bus. Here's how she opens the novel. Chain night happens once a week on Thursdays. Once a week, the defining moment for 60 women takes place. For some of the 60, that defying moment happens over and over. For them, it is routine. For me, it happened only once. I was woken up at 2 a.m. and shackled and counted. Romy Leslie Hall, inmate W314159, and lined up with the others for an all-night ride up the valley. So we know who the story is about, we know where she is, and what she's about to embark on in this scene, and it's compelling. And then she puts us right on the bus with her. As our bus exited the jail perimeter, I glued myself to the mesh-reinforced window to try to see the world. There wasn't much to look at. Underpasses and on-ramps, dark, deserted boulevards. No one was on the street. We were passing through a moment in the night so remote that traffic lights had ceased to go from green to red and merely blinked a constant yellow. Okay, so the first chapter focuses on this all-night bus ride. During it, she interacts with other inmates. She slips into thought and memory to give us context about her situation. We learn some key things about her, but the opening makes us want to know more. It doesn't front-load how she wound up in jail, what her crime was, how long she's serving, etc. We learn a little more during the setup, but there's a lot of withholding and delay. So we meet her in the middle of something compelling and mysterious. We don't know where she and the other inmates are being taken to or why, and we read to know more. So number one, you want to introduce your character in a compelling way. You want to do it in the middle of some situation or activity and in a particular place. This helps establish your character's world as he or she knows it. Now, your character may be content and happy in their known world, or they may be miserable and discontent. But even if they're not happy with the world as it is now, it's what they know. It's familiar. At some point, they'll be forced out of the known into the unknown. Your first scenes will establish the world as he or she knows it. So we want to meet your protagonist in the middle of some situation or activity in a particular place. Okay, number two, introduce your protagonist's main story problem. This is the problem that will occupy them for the rest of the story. So you want to introduce it. So ask yourself, what's the main problem my protagonist has to solve, and how can I introduce it? In a character-driven story or memoir, it's usually an internal problem that has to be conveyed in something external. In a plot-driven story, like The Mars Room, external events trigger an internal problem or conflict, generally speaking. So if you're writing more about an interior problem or goal, how can you bring it into the world of the real? How can the internal problem be captured in a situation, something that's unusual, concrete, and specific? Don't just give us something mundane, make it unforgettable. For example, in Lucy Greeley's memoir, Autobiography of a Face, the prologue is about taking horses out to pony parties for children's birthdays. That is what the whole prologue is built around. She uses the pony parties to frame her main story problem, which is an internal one. It's how she begins to externalize the inner turmoil that occupies her for the rest of the memoir. She leads with it. My friend Stephen and I used to do pony parties together. The festivities took place on the well-tended lawns of the vast suburban communities that had sprung up around Diamond D Stables in the rural acres of Rockland County. So we know where we are, and we know what this introduction will be about. And on page 3, she gets to the heart of the matter. Once we reached the party, there was a great rush of excitement. The children, realizing that the ponies had arrived, would come running from the backyard in their silly hats. Their now forgotten balloons, bobbing colorfully behind them, would fly off in search of some tree or telephone wire. My pleasure at seeing the children didn't last long, however. I knew what was coming. As soon as they got over the thrill of being near the ponies, they'd notice me. Half my jaw was missing, which gave my face a strange triangular shape, accentuated by the fact that I was unable to keep my mouth completely closed. When I first started doing pony parties, my hair was still short and wispy, still growing in from the chemo. But as it grew, I made things worse by continuously bowing my head and hiding behind the curtain of hair, furtively peering out at the world like some nervous actor. Unlike the actor, though, I didn't secretly relish my audience, and if it were possible, I would have stood behind that curtain forever, my head bent in an external act of deference. I was, however, dependent upon my audience. Their approval or disapproval defined everything for me, and I believed with every cell in my body that approval wasn't written into my particular script. I was 14 years old. So there's that moment of acute awareness, and this problem occupies her for the rest of the memoir, but it's all embedded in something specific and concrete, the pony parties. Then on page 5, she backtracks a few months earlier when she had finished chemotherapy and had started looking in the yellow pages for stables where she might work. She doesn't lead with the chemotherapy or even the cancer. She gives us the situation to frame her dilemma, then backs up to tell us what led to that dilemma. So the prologue encapsulates what this story is going to be about, and it makes us care immediately. It's not that her experience is universal, but her feelings of being rejected, feeling like an outcast, well, that's something we all have felt at various times, certainly in adolescence, and let's be honest, sometimes even in adulthood. The pain of feeling different, unattractive, unlovable, utterly alone. The pony parties mark a turning point for her, the awareness of how others react to her. So the author leads with this in the prologue and then backtracks in chapter one to the incident that happened several years before, a collision in the school playground that ultimately led to her cancer diagnosis. But here's what I want to drive home for you. She doesn't give us the story chronologically. So you can structure your setup according to emotional significance. A common misstep is feeling like you need to tell the story chronologically, everything that happened. And so the opening pages can be a tedious meandering before we get to the good stuff, and it's usually buried in a lot of extraneous details. So you want to introduce the main story problem. Introduce, don't give it all away. Okay, on to number three, the stakes. Give your characters something or someone to care about. What's at stake? The way to make us care in your setup scenes is to give your character someone or something to care about. And I would do this in the very first scene. So ask yourself, what's something he or she cares about and why? This will bond readers to your protagonist and your story right away. For example, why the ponies? Why work at a stable? It's not just a part-time job, it's salvation for her. On page 5, she gives us a little background about the stable for context and contrast. And then she gets to why this is so important to her, why it's meaningful. Though I had to suffer through the pony parties, I was more willing to do so, to spend time alone with the horses. I considered animals bearers of higher truth, and I wanted to align myself with their knowledge. I thought animals were the only beings capable of understanding me. So this bonds us to her because we can relate to that feeling of not being accepted by anyone but the animals around her. So it's salvation for her. And here's an excerpt from The Mars Room. Now, at one point along the bus ride, they pass an amusement park, Magic Mountain. And the person she's sitting next to tells her this story. There was a lady on my unit who stole children at Magic Mountain, Laura Lipp said, she and her sicko husband. She told me how they did it. People trusted her and her husband because they were old. You know, sweet, gentle, elderly people and a mother might have children running in three directions and go off to chase one. And the old lady, I bunked with her at CIW, and she told me the whole story. She would be sitting there knitting and offer to keep an eye on the child. As soon as the parent was out of sight, this child was escorted to a bathroom with a knife under his chin. This old lady and her husband had a system worked out. The kid was fitted with a wig, different clothes, and then that sneaky old couple muscled the poor thing out of the park. That's horrible, I said, and tried to lean away from her as best I could in my chains. I have a child of my own, Jackson. I love my son, but it's hard for me to think about him. I try not to. Okay, now again, she's not giving us everything about him. It's a pain point for her, but it introduces us to what's at stake for her. So this comes on page 3 of the first chapter. And then on page 15, she returns to this idea of Jackson. We still had 6 hours to go. I started to think about those kids forced into wigs in a bathroom stall at Magic Mountain, outfitted briskly with sunglasses and different clothes. They would end up unrecognizable, not only in their new disguises, but in their new lives. They would be strangers, different children, ones who were tainted and ruined by their own kidnapping, long before they ever got used to whatever evil purpose was their new and abrupt destiny. I saw the kids in their wigs and the scattered crowd of amusement park goers who would not know to help a lost and stolen child. I saw Jackson as if he was being torn from me by an old woman knitting on a bench, and there was nothing I could do but watch the pictures of his little freckled face in my mind, pictures that floated and pulsed and would not fade or disperse. So she returns to the story told to her about the stolen children and brings it back to what matters to her most. What's at stake? Her son. And then there's a space break and we get some background, a little more on Jackson. Jackson is with my mother. It's the single grace in my life that he has her, even if I don't like her much myself. She is not a psycho grandmother who knits on a bench. She's a gruff and chain-smoking German woman who gets by on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. She has a glacial manner with me, but she is loving enough to Jackson. This introduces what's at stake. If she were just a woman in prison, well, that would still be a compelling story problem, but by introducing us to the person she cares about the most, it ups the stakes. Okay, last one, number four. You want to introduce the threat of someone or something that will cause trouble or upend your character's life as he or she knows it. In the Mars room, when we meet Romy, she's been in prison for 2 years, so the threat has already happened. She doesn't tell us the whole story in the setup. The promise is that we'll learn more about him as the novel progresses, but this is how she introduces him, and this is on page 9. I'm 29. 14 years is forever if that's what I have to live. In any case, it's more than twice that, 37 years, before I will see a parole board, at which point, if they grant me it, I can start my second life sentence. I have 2 consecutive sentences plus 6 years. I don't plan on living a long life or a short life necessarily. I have no plans at all. The thing is, you keep existing whether you have a plan to do so or not until you don't exist, and then your plans are meaningless. But not having plans doesn't mean I don't have regrets. If I had never worked at the Mars Room, if I had never met Creep Kennedy, if Creep Kennedy had not decided to stalk me, but he did decide to, and then he did it relentlessly. If none of that had happened, I would not be on a bus heading for a life in a concrete slot. Now notice, we don't get the whole story about Creep Kennedy, but we know that he had something to do, his stalking her had something to do with her being in jail. We can assume she probably murdered him, but she's not giving it all away. It's very effective, and it makes us want to know more. Okay, let's recap. Your setup is roughly the first 25% of your story, so you don't want to squander it or front-load it with information you can delay until either later in your setup scenes or later in Act 2. The setup gives the reader a promise of what the story is about. It gives us the promise of what we're going to learn more about. So number one, thrust your character in the middle of a compelling situation. Let us meet him or her there. Number two, introduce the main story problem. So important that you introduce the main story problem. Number three, introduce the stakes by introducing what or who they care about. Would we care about Romy's fate if it weren't for her son? This gives her a reason to fight for her freedom. And number four, introduce the threat of someone or something that will change your character's life as he or she knows it. The key thing in your setup is to introduce the elements at play in your story. It's not to give it all away. So there you have it. Thanks for hanging out with me today. And if you know any writers who need some support in their writing, please share this episode or the Writer Unleashed podcast in general. And if you love what you're listening to, subscribe on your favorite listening platform and please leave me a review. Reading how this podcast impacts your writing truly lights me up and helps me create topics for the show. Till next time, keep writing, and I'll talk to you soon.